Okay, I'd like to call the House Resources Committee meeting to order today. Today is March 20th, 2024. We are in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dybert, Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chairman McKay. We have a quorum to do business. We have honored guests in the audience, Julie Kicka, President of the AFN. Welcome, Julie. And a Deputy Commissioner is here from the DEC, Emma. Thank you, Emma, for being here. And I'd like to thank the staff today, Cal, Zach, and Rose, for helping us run the meeting. So initially here, I'd like to make a brief announcement. We did have a sad news on our committee here recently. I'd like to both welcome Rose Larson to the McKay team here and express my sincere gratitude and condolences to Ed King, our former House Resources Committee aide, who has had to step away from working for my office as he deals with the passing of his mother, Lorena Leanne Pease. Ed King has been an integral part of my team the last session and a half and is one of the best staffers a representative could possibly have. Both myself and my chief of staff, Trevor Jepson, are incredibly appreciative of all Ed has done for us, and we feel very lucky to have been able to work with him the past year. We wish Ed well in this difficult time, and our hearts go out to him and his family. We look forward to having Ed back in the building if he chooses to return. So I just wanted to recognize that on behalf of Ed. And then remind everyone, please place your cell phones on silent. So let us get started. We have three things on the agenda today. We are going to consider a governor's appointee for the Department of Environmental Conservation, Commissioner Emma Pocan. And we will also consider House Bill 295 dealing with salmon hatchery permits. This will be the initial hearing in House Resources on that bill. And then finally, we'll finish up with House Joint Resolution 22, the resident subsistence use of fish and game. We will have invited testimony today and during that session. So first of all, let's talk to the consideration of the governor's appointee, Emma Pocan. Ms. Pocan, if you could please come up, put your name on the record, and tell us about yourself.
Thank you, Chair McKay. I am Emma Pocan. I'm the commissioner designee for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thank you for your time today. I'm both pleased and humbled to be here today in this capacity. DEC really has a big job, from water and air permits for industrial facilities to approvals and support for community water, electric, and solid waste utilities, to food worker cards for individuals working in food service, to working with individual homeowners to address pollution issues in communities like Fairbanks. We really have, a big job, and we touch a lot of the state. And I think the breadth of that purpose and role probably informed the legislature charging DEC with the mission of not just protecting human health and the environment, but doing so in a way that also maintains the economic and social welfare of Alaskans at the forefront of our minds. I hadn't necessarily started out with the thought or the objective of becoming the commissioner for DEC, but reflecting on the role, the mission of the agency and the work that we do, I do think that I'm well positioned and well grounded to do a good job for Alaska and for our residents. I grew up in a small town where the prominent industries were timber and bluestone. Mom is a teacher, dad is a forester. His role in the timber industry, managing private properties, owners of forest land for timber production, while ensuring that the logging is done in a manner that protects the environment, that protects trout streams and water quality, that ensures the ecological considerations are accounted for. While also being in a community where those resource jobs really were very important to the welfare of residents, I think grounded me in a perspective that fits well with DEC's mission. I went off to law school with environmental practice as my particular objective and specifically in mind, and got my master's degree in the studies of environmental law at the same time as I got my JD. And then, like a lot of Alaskans, I came here for a job, and I came for what I thought was going to be a limited period of time. I came for a year-long clerkship with the Fairbanks Superior Court. And then, like a lot of Alaskans, that turned a lot more permanent. First year turned into a second year of clerking. And then after that, I got the job with the North Slope Borough as their Environmental and Natural Resource Council. And I think at that point, the hook was fairly well set. That time in Utqiagvik, I think, was really important for me. And Fairbanks really was an introduction to the state, but living and working in Utqiagvik was really much more of an education. In part, there was the experience in the application of environmental law in the state and how the federal government interacts with our communities. But probably more important was the education, what it means to live off the road system in Alaska, like so many of our residents do. The challenges of logistics, the timing of barges, the importance of subsistence, not just for sustenance, but for culture and community, and the value of community. I also gained a deeper appreciation for the importance of economic opportunity and what that property tax base means for the North Slope Borough and the services that they can provide to their residents, and what that means for the quality of life in our communities. I moved to Anchorage for a spot with the Department of Law in January 2013. And have been in state service since then. My most recent assignment with law was in supporting DEC. I moved over for the deputy commissioner role about 4 years ago. I'm really grateful, and I want to say thank you to the folks at DEC, the many people who have helped me learn and who carry out the important work that DEC does every day. I do want to say also that the work that DEC does is so important. I believe in our work, and that it's an important piece of what keeps Alaska an attractive place to live and work. My hope is for many people to continue having the experience of so many Alaskans like me, who came for a week or a season or a year and found that Alaska's become home. And with that, I would say thank you, and happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Pocon. Are there questions from the committee? I'm not sure who's first. Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Commissioner Designee Pocan, thank you for being here. I appreciate the recitation of your history and your experience. It's always good to hear someone's Alaska origin stories. So you've been in the deputy commissioner's slot at DEC for, you said, 4 years, and now you're aspiring to ascend to be the commissioner yourself after Jason Bruni. Kind of a general philosophical question, what would differentiate your term as commissioner from Jason's, or what would characterize your term? What would you hope that your term as that commissioner would be known for?
I hope that my term as commissioner will be known for the work that DEC does as an agency. I think that my role is in working with our teams to ensure that the objectives that the legislature and the governor have set out for us are accomplished. I'd like to see DEC be a good place to work, and I'd like to see stability for the agency so that that core function can continue and our folks have confidence in what their role is and what they're to be accomplishing.
Okay. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Commissioner Designee Pocan. I just wanted to comment that I appreciate that you've got experience in not just multiple areas of the state, but different types of communities. And then there's also a lot of regulations in DEC. It's a very regulatory agency, and I think your legal background will really help with that. So I appreciate seeing someone well-rounded in Alaska up for this job. Thank you.
Any other questions for Commissioner Pocan? Representative Sadler, absolutely. Second chance.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Pocan, in your view, what is the area of greatest need in conserving Alaska's environment, protecting, conserving, however you interpret your mission?
There's probably, through the chair, Representative Sadler, there's probably a lot of different ways to answer that question. I think The thing that first comes to mind for me are places where we have pollution to an extent that health standards are implicated. So, for example, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards not being met in the community of North Pole. And the work that needs to be done to sort of help the community get to a place where the air is clean and healthy. There are other places around the state where there may be water quality issues or air quality issues, but that non-attainment for the air quality standards is an important one that we have to work on.
Thank you, Chair.
Hey, Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. Nice to see you, Commissioner. Commissioner designee, I guess. I don't know what we're supposed to call you, Commissioner. So I'm particularly interested, and we've had many conversations last year about Village Safe Water. Mm-hmm. So there's 43-ish, I think, villages in the state that have no septic system, no real viable water other than wells and septic, or no sewer system. They have septic. So I'm interested in knowing your thoughts on, I think it seemed to me that about half of them were actually looking for some sort of a septic. And I know that the DEC has a pretty significant chunk of change ready to help them out. So maybe you could just flesh out a little bit, not too much, on what you're doing with as far as figuring out who wants a septic or sewer system, who can afford to maintain a sewer system, which you and I both know. I have a village or a town in my district that's struggling with that, but who can afford to maintain it and that sort of thing. Maybe just touch on a little bit. I know that a lot of my constituents are really interested in that, and then I have a follow-up question.
Thank you, Representative McCabe, through the chair. This could have been, I think, an answer to the last question as well in terms of important issues in the state. So there are a number of communities that do not yet have piped water service, and I think it is important that where we can establish that and it can be sustained over time, that we work with communities to get that service provided. Earlier this year, with our facilities group, we did make some changes to the eligibility criteria for those communities with first-time service. We are using best practice scores differently now, so those are no longer going to be a hurdle for first-time service for communities. And instead, we're looking more broadly. I think we took a step back and thought, okay, what's really our core concern here, and what were we trying to accomplish with that tool? And really the concern is sort of that ability to maintain and operate over time, that affordability question that you raised as well. And so instead, we're looking at sustainability plans and what is the community's plan for sustaining that service over time. We want to make the investments. We want to ensure that utility service is maintained over time. And we really have a great opportunity currently with the federal investments in infrastructure projects. And we want to seize that momentum, seize that opportunity, but we want to also make sure that it lasts and that it can be sustained over time. And it doesn't have to necessarily be whether or not the community itself can sustain the rates over time, right? Like there may be opportunities for funding through Indian Health Service or other funding mechanisms, grant monies to help support the ongoing operations and maintenance over time. But we do want to ensure that there is a plan financially for those systems.
Thanks.
Follow-up, Representative McCabe.
I appreciate that. So I think we can agree that the overarching need is for clean water, right? And I think also if you look in statutes, the definition of a village is a census-designated area less than 2,500 people, right? So as you probably know, as we've talked about before, Talkeetna actually fits that definition, but they are in the road system. But they are struggling with clean water. The core of the town has a little bit of clean water. They have a problematic sewer system. They have money to repair that. But there are a great number of residents outside of Talkeetna that have no way to get clean water other than a spring-fed deal on the side of the parks, which is about halfway up there. That's why you see all those cars stop there, even in the wintertime. So I'm trying to get them a well house, just like many, many villages that I've flown into have. They have a community laundry, well house, whatever, where they can go get clean water. So, you know, you mentioned Indian Health Service, and I get that our definition for villages has always been sort of native villages off the road system. But our statutes actually say Talkeetna, Trapper Creek, Chase, some of those places up the highway where Alaskans are moving now out of, you know, where our population's moving north on the highway. They don't have water. Is that something you think that the DEC would be willing to solve? Putting you on the spot, I know it, but.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, is something that we would certainly be interested in working with the community to solve, yes. I did live in a dry cabin for a period of time in Fairbanks. I appreciate the inconvenience that can be. We do want to have running water for all of our communities on and off the road system and ensure that there is clean, safe, healthy water available for folks, and also that wastewater is managed appropriately. So I'm not going to tell you that I know off the top of my head all of the eligibility criteria for the grants and loans that DEC has available that we can facilitate support for communities. But I am confident that we're happy to look at the circumstances and evaluate what a good pathway forward is.
Okay, follow up, Representative McCabe.
Thanks, I appreciate that. And what I'm particularly worried about in this case is not so much, I mean, we're going to get clean water. People are going to get water somehow. Mm-hmm. But I'm worried that they're on the side of the road parked trying to access a pipe that hooks into a river somewhere a little bit upstream, and it's dangerous. And if we could provide as a state something that's a little bit more stable for them, that'd be great. So that's why I'm specifically asking that question. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions for Commissioner Pocan? All right, seeing none, let the record show that we have held a hearing for the consideration of the governor's appointee, Emma Pocan, for commissioner of the DEC. And we'll take a brief at ease while we all sign the confirmation report that's required. So brief at ease. House Resources, we now will take up House Bill 295 relating to salmon hatchery permits. This is a House Rules Committee bill by request of the governor. Today we have with us several representatives from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for our hearing. First, Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang is here. He is on by Teams. Can you hear me all right, Commissioner?
I can. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And also have Joe Falco at the table. He is the legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game, and he will do the sectional shortly. And then we're supposed to have Flip Pryor, aquaculture section chief for the Division of Commercial Fisheries, on the line for questions. So can we confirm, we don't have Flip, okay? Flip's here. Okay, I'm sorry. Why don't you come up, Flip, in case there's questions. Sorry about that. All right, so I'd like to invite Commissioner Lang to put himself on the record and begin his presentation of this bill.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I'm the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Sorry I couldn't be with you today. I'm up at the Alaska Board of Game meeting in Fairbanks and attending to Yukon salmon fishery issues the last 3 days, so my apologies. This bill would allow private nonprofit hatchery operators to sell live salmon to private persons or organizations for the limited purpose of stocking lakes in Alaska. This would include several species of trout, including rainbow trout, which are the primary hatchery product used by the state to stock lakes across Alaska. Unfortunately, state hatchery facilities don't have surplus fish to sell as the current demand for stocking public access lakes exceeds our production capacity. Additionally, state hatcheries were paid for with sport angler dollars matched with federal Dingell Johnson dollars. Because of this, the department must limit its stocking efforts to lakes with the most benefit to all sport anglers, and we typically use a publicly developed stocking plan to determine which lakes to stock. This bill would provide for additional recreational, food security, and economic opportunities by allowing private nonprofit hatchery operators the option to sell fish to individuals or groups under the Department of Fish and Game's existing permitting structure. I want to emphasize that. This would all be done under the Department of Fish and Game's existing permitting structure. Although management concerns associated with stock lakes are minimal, fish stocking is stringently regulated in the state of Alaska. Before purchasing the fish, the individual group would be required to obtain a fish transport permit, and the requested species, stock, life stage, and stocking location would be evaluated and approved or denied through this permitting process. To reduce the potential for negative impacts on wild fish populations, the department uses sterile stocking products when practical and typically proves the use of reproductively viable fish in lakes that are landlocked where fish cannot escape. These are some of the factors that we would be considering during the rigorous review process the department conducts for any permits that would be issued if this bill were to pass. This permitting process would ensure that live fish sold to the public would not adversely affect Alaska's fish and wildlife populations. Lastly, it's important to note this change simply allows for the sale of fish. There is no mandate or requirement for a private nonprofit hatchery operator to provide this service. The bill could create new revenue opportunities for interested hatchery operators and encourage Alaskans to engage in additional recreational fishing activities. More importantly, it provides Alaskans greater access to a resource that is vital for food security. So in closing, if I could just say that during the COVID crisis, there was a lot of requests. People went to stock lakes and they went to different areas to look for alternative food sources. And when the governor and I were talking about what could be done as part of the Food Security Task Force moving forward, this was one option that we thought of. We could basically, since we don't have the hatchery capacity, work with our private nonprofit hatchery system that we have in the state to give them the opportunity to sell fish so people could stock lakes, especially in some of our rural areas, that they would have that alternative food source in case there was another food security crisis that we'd be facing in the state. So with that, I'm open to any questions you may have, or we could let Joe do the sectional and the fiscal update.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Lang, and I would like to have Liaison Falco go ahead and do the sectional so we can get that out of the way. So please put yourself on the record and do the sectional analysis.
For the record, Joe Falco, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. Section 1 of the bill adds a new subsection to the statutes for salmon hatchery permits, clarifying that nothing in a permit prohibits the sale of salmon for purposes of stocking lakes in the state to a person or entity that receives a fish transport permit under AS 1605-251. Section 2 amends the salmon hatchery permit statutes to insert the word wild regarding the board's authority to amend a permit. And through the chair, if I may, just briefly cover the summary of changes as well.
Yes, please proceed.
Version A to B, summary of changes. Section 1 corrects a drafting error. We're replacing an incorrect citation with the correct statutory authority for fish transport permits. This section has also been redrafted for clarity, specifying sale of hatchery-produced salmon. However, this change is stylistic and does not change the original intent of the language. Section 2 is a new section that amends AS 1610-440B to insert the word wild. Inserting the word wild clarifies the Commissioner of Fish and Game's authority is permitting the hatchery operation and the Board of Fisheries authority is allocating the common property resource. Adding the word wild also conforms salmon hatchery permit statutes with the more recently enabled shellfish enhancement statutes, which already include the word wild regarding the board's authority to amend a permit. And with that, open it up to questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Falco. So are there questions from the committee for Commissioner Lang or Mr. Falco? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm not sure who's best to answer this, but Commissioner Vincent Lang, I think you went briefly on a couple of things that would be considered during the permit process, and I understand that's probably something that still needs to be developed, but I'd appreciate a little bit more discussion on what would be considered during a permit process.
Yeah, so I'd be through the chair. This is Commissioner Vincent Lang again. We already have the permitting process in place, so we use that to permit a wide variety of different releases of hatchery operations across the PNP system already, and we use it to actually permit ourselves to release fish into stock lakes. We look at whether the lake is landlocked. We look at whether or not the fish are going to be sterile, they're going to be released. We look at what the potential impact is, and only until we're convinced that we're not going to cause any damage to Alaska's wild stocks would we issue that permit. And I have Mr. Pryor here with us, and he's our guy that does a lot of the fish habitat permitting transports. If you get further questions, or if I missed anything, maybe we can give Flip a chance to dig down a little deeper.
Okay, please put yourself on the record.
Yep, for the record, I'm Flip Pryor. I'm the aquaculture section chief for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I'll start over. Flip Pryor, Aquaculture Section Chief, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Commissioner Lang covered everything pretty well. We do look at a number of things before issuing a fish transport permit. What he didn't mention, pathology reviews the permit, genetics reviews the permit, area management biologists for both sport and commercial fisheries review the permit, looking at all the things that Commissioner Lang mentioned. Vincent Lang.
Through the chair, Joe Felkel again. I just want to add to Mr. Pryor and the commissioner's statements that in the bill packet should be a relevant statutes and regulations supporting document, and it cites all of the relevant regulations for fish transport permits and talks a little bit about that process.
All right. Did I see another hand up? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Pryor, I guess, not being that informed about the hatchery system, there's a conversation about the private nonprofit hatcheries. In essence, this bill is to help deputize or to assist private nonprofit hatcheries in generating more fish, I think. Is that the general case?
Addressing the question through the chair, it currently right now, private nonprofits can only sell eggs to other private nonprofits or the state. This just allows them to sell eggs to people in the public. Okay. For the state, for stocking lakes in the state.
Okay. And follow-up?
Follow-up, and Representative
again,
Sadler.
I'm going to give you the opportunity, Mr. Pryor, through the chair, to kind of explain. So we're trying to encourage private individuals to stock lakes with salmon eggs, right? And I guess what's your feedback mechanism to know that this is working well and all the things, all the good guidelines and safeguards that were mentioned?
Okay, through the chair. I think I don't know that we're pushing private nonprofits to sell eggs to the public. It's just allowing the public a place where they can get eggs. Does that answer your question?
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Commissioner Lang, please comment.
Yeah, so if I could kind of help this along. So in essence, what we have is we have a demand that's not being met right now. The state can't provide that demand for stockfish into lakes that, because we simply, our two existing sport fish hatcheries are at full capacity, and we basically, when we have a stocking plan, and we're not even meeting the demands of that stocking plan. When we thought about it, why not let the P&Ps, who basically have the capacity to raise these fish up, get into the business of selling some fish to some of these individuals out there? As part of our permitting process, we do have reporting requirements back to us that tell us what the success rate, you know, what happens with that as a reporting process that goes back in to evaluate the success or non-success of those programs, because they're not a permit forever. They're kind of a permit that gets us a time duration that we can reevaluate them. So there is an evaluation mechanism going forward. But this is basically trying to use the existing infrastructure of Alaska to produce that, meet that demand, to meet food security issues and also some demand in some private lakes out there that have no public access into them.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any further questions for our panel on this bill? All right. Seeing none, I'd like to thank Mr. Felkel, Mr. Pryor for being with us today. And then I'd like to ask Commissioner Lang to stay on for our next bill. I think you're testifying on the next bill.
Yes, I am. I'll stay online.
So we'll take a brief, very brief at ease to reset the table. On the record, House Resources. Today, our third subject is House Joint Resolution 22 relating to residents' subsistence use of fish and game, introduced by our Representative Baker from Kotzebue. We'll bring the bill back before the committee. And today we will be taking invited testimony. And at this point, we are honored to have Julie Kitka, the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, here with us. It's so nice to see you today, President Kitka. And what I'd like to do is ask our great friend, Representative Baker, to introduce you in more detail.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say that I don't really think I can go into much more detail as the president's reputation precedes her, I'd also like to welcome Dr. Rosita Worrell, and I believe Gayla Hoseth was online, I think. Yep, she's top left corner there on the screen. So I'd just like to say thank you for making the effort to come down, and really appreciate having the insight from AFN on this topic, which near and dear to my heart and is really hopefully going to be something that we can continue the discussion further. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, very well. So, Ms. Kicker, thank you for being here today. And I would like to invite you to put your name on the record and begin your testimony on HDR 22.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is an honor to be here today. My name is Julie Kitka, and I have the honor of serving as the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. With me today is Dr. Rosita Worrell, a long-time Native leader, very distinguished, who I'm proud to have join us at the table today. She's on the AFN Subsistence Committee, and as well as Gayla Hoseth, who's online, who is the chairman of our AFN Subsistence Committee. So we were told we had about 15 minutes, so I hope that's about right. So I thought I'd do 5 minutes, 5 minutes, and 5 minutes, give or take. We'll try to be fast, too.
No, you take your time, President Kick. We've got some time, so we definitely want to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, sir. It is an honor to be here. It is a monumentous task to raise a constitutional amendment on subsistence kind of out of the blue. And I'll tell you why I described that. It was first raised in 1990 as a result of the McDowell case, which the state Supreme Court found that the state of Alaska did not have the authority in the state constitution to have a statute that was in compliance with Title VIII of ANILCA. And that created a crisis in the state. We worked with Senator Stevens, Senator Frank Murkowski, Congressman Don Young, the governor, the Native leadership, many stakeholders across the state to try to address that. We knew that the state wanted to have a unified management system, and they were prohibited from doing it just because of the way that the court ruled and the way the Constitution was. So that was the beginning. Again, the decision was in December of 1989, and the first session of the legislature dealing with this was in 1990. So for nearly 34 years ago that this first came out in front of the legislature. And I wanted to highlight a few things about that before I get into some recommendations that we have for you. The first constitutional amendment was introduced in the 16th legislature in 1989 to 1990. And that nearly passed. As you know, a constitutional amendment requires the supermajority on that, and we failed by one vote in that time frame. The 17th legislature from 1991 to 1992, there's a legislature that didn't deal with it. The 18th legislatures, there were several constitutional amendments proposed that were introduced, and none of those were voted on. In the 19th legislature, 1995 to 1996, Governor Knowles proposed another constitutional amendment, this time, and I'll cover the types of constitutional amendment these were, but that did not go anywhere. And in the 20th legislature, Governor Knowles introduced subsistence legislation, including a constitutional amendment, and that's 1997 to 1998, and again, did not have the support of the two-thirds. The 21st legislature from 1991 to 2000, Governor Knowles introduced another amendment, but the legislature failed to pass it. So you can see this is an issue that's been before the legislature for a long time. Our organization, the Alaska Federation of Natives, worked hand in hand with our congressional delegation and our governor and leaders across the state to try to obtain that constitutional amendment and help the state regain the legal authority to be able to do a statute on that. After 10 years, we gave up because the state appeared to us to not want that authority. And so it has not been on the table in front of the legislature or before us since 2000, so 25 years. So the first recommendation I have to you on this amendment that Representative Baker put forward is you need to take your time. For Alaskans are not aware of this. I don't believe that there's time in this session to adopt this. And I'd urge that you set up maybe with your colleagues from the Senate Resources Committee, a fact-finding group that can tackle a number of questions that when you bring this back to the legislature in January of 2025, that you have some things that you've reached out to people. Plus, Alaskans have a chance to express their views to you directly because we found over the years there's nothing like this issue to galvanize people's wanting to express their views and very strong views. And there's no way that a small group of people, even in the legislature, can move fast on this. It kind of like, let's deal with oil taxes, but let's do it in this one room and let's not have all the stakeholders around the table, right? You can imagine how that would infuriate people. It's the same thing on this issue. The common themes in the proposed amendments were a rural subsistence priority. Another one was a native and rural subsistence priority. Another one was a rural plus priority. And another one was a flexible priority. So there's many different ways to do a constitutional amendment. And I think that if you take the time in the fact-finding and you open up a process that allows a lot of input on that, you'll find that people will have some very good ideas. The other thing to keep in mind, and it's a little criticism of Representative Baker's legislation, is subsistence is basically in Alaska Native hunting and fishing and cultural tradition. And to have no mention of our people in the constitutional amendment or any recognition of our 12,000 years of history in occupying and living on this land on that really comes across offensive. And I'm being really honest with you. But also, it ignores that Alaska Natives have a special federal trust responsibility with the federal government. So where the state says, we're looking at federal overreach. Alaska Natives are looking at, we're looking at federal protection. You're looking at overreach. We're looking at protections. Our goal in coming to talk to you today is we would like to help you in what you're doing, but we also want to accommodate the realities that deal with our people, the realities of our special trust relationship with the federal government, which is based from the U.S. Constitution. And there's references in the state compact when Alaska became a state that we weren't to be disturbed in our hunting and gathering cultures and activity. If we could mesh those type of things together through dialogue and everything, might be able to pull out a rabbit out of the hat and have a solution. I'm not saying that people will agree with it because on the current system that we have a dual management, it's been going on for nearly 34 years. And it is a direct result of the failure of the state to give itself the legal authority. So the federal government came in. We petitioned them to come in. We have engaged with them over across all these years to try to improve the system that they put in. There's been numerous litigation that's been going on during this time frame in which you had clarifications of terms and processes and so forth. And our people have spent decades now trying to make that federal subsistence board and the dual management system work. People put, you know, 20 years of their life on that. They're not going to instantly say, oh, I want the state to do it now after I spent 20 years doing it. Mm. So my second recommendation besides doing a fact-finding trip on that is I think that you need to get rid of the non-subsistence use areas. And this is something that you could do in this session right now. Repeal the non-subsistence use areas that pulls out a segment of Alaskans that are not involved in this. That was done during Governor Hickel's term, and his people, even after as he signed it, he called it a Frankenstein bill. It wasn't even what he had in mind. And so our view is you should level the playing field by getting rid of the non-subsistence use areas and then getting rid of the use of all Alaskans or subsistence users. And I use the example of plumbers. If the state came and said, all Alaskans are plumbers, and now I'm going to do something for plumbers, everybody knows who's a plumber and who's not a plumber. So why does the state have a policy saying everybody is? It makes all the continuing efforts, such a constitutional amendment, meaningless because they're going, they're not even talking about us, or they're talking about people that aren't even subsistence people, right? So I think that that's something that the legislature can do this session, is remove that. And again, to me, that gets us to a level playing field to begin the dialogue and go forward.
Mr. President Kick, I'd have to just stop briefly here. I'd like to recognize Representative Edgman has joined us. Please continue. Sorry.
Okay. The next thing I'd like to recommend that you do, as you do in your fact finding, is scope out what a unified state management system looks like and spend time scoping out something that's the best in the entire country. Alaska is 2.5 times the size of Texas. It's the largest state in our union. It's an area that's got some of the largest runs of fish, animals, and whatever. We deserve to have the very best system that there is. And I, for one, cannot say that's what we have now. And I will grant that people have spent a lot of time improving it and working on it and dedication. And so I'm not saying that to insult anybody or whatever. But our sense is, if you want to say, people, we want to help the state get a unified system, you need to develop the best there is and a system that's there for the future, that takes into account climate change, that takes into account the warming of the oceans and the migration of the fish. And so I really urge that you spend some time and you do it with stakeholders and say, in an ideal world, what should this look like? How should it be funded? How is science meshed into it? How is indigenous knowledge meshed into it? And I think that would help the process going forward. Also, evaluating the court cases that the state's involved in that are against subsistence people and Alaska Natives on that. We all know that right now in the district court, the United States versus the state of Alaska is a very significant and important case that we should be getting the first court decision by early May of this year. That's a really important issue to us, and I know it's important to the state on that, but recognize this litigation that's going on is influencing people's attitudes about the state and what the state's doing. And how can the state say, well, I want to do all this stuff, and then you're in litigation, and the state's lawyers are saying all this other stuff on that. It mixes it up, and it appears to be in conflict to me. Again, the reason why we have a dual system is, in our view, the failure of the state. Fact that they didn't give themselves the legal authority to do that. The other area that we know that the state is looking at is possible ANILCA amendments. If you are thinking about trying to support that, put those on the table so people know what you're talking about. Nobody ever says federal or state law is ever perfect on that, but those ought to not be surprises to people. People ought to know what it is. And as you're looking at constitutional amendments, I just want to warn you, there's things that we've rejected in the past is not acceptable. We won't accept having subsistence turned into a welfare program that's just based on need. Subsistence is much more than that. It's our culture. It's our people feeding their families. It's sharing and so forth on that. So really resist the idea of supporting anything that turns it into that, because you just won't get people's support behind that. On this scoping of or fact finding on that, really urge that what you do is explore in the fact finding the history of this conflict between the federal and state government, and explore the inherent rights of Alaska Natives from time immemorial, protected in the Statehood Compact, protected the special trust relationship with the federal government derived from the U.S. Constitution. Understand that. We could send you documentation that you can read to do that. We've submitted that a couple of years ago in on the Senate when the Education Compacting Bill did. We did extensive legal briefing on that. Fact-finding, find out what is going on with the shortages right now with the fish and with the low caribou on that. And be prepared to have the state to be crystal clear, what are they doing about it? That's the burning issue that are on people's mind right now, is not helping the state get a unified system, is what are we going to do when we don't get any fish this spring or this summer or no caribou? What are you going to do? The state's got to be crystal clear. This is what's going on. This is how we back that up. This is what we're doing about it, and this is our plan. Nobody knows what the state is doing, and the federal government, the same way, needs to be held their feet to the fire. What are you doing on this shortage, and what are you going to do about this, how it affects real people on that? We offer to put together a lunch and learn for this committee, as I mentioned earlier, for House and Senate one later on this session, if you want to spend more time on that. We could pull some people together, but approach this with some really concrete goals, because it's a very complex. There's many pieces to this whole thing, and we would want you to be experts in this, and what comes out of your deliberations to be something that's successful. So I'd like to turn it over to Rosita right now, and I may pull in a couple more comments after that. Rosita?
Okay, just would like to comment. President Kick, I actually remember the huge debate in 1990, and it was certainly rigorous and, divisive. And as I look back on it, maybe it's kind of a sad time in our history. So, so we have several more folks that want to testify. So, Rosita, if you'd like to put your name on the record, and maybe you can give us 5 minutes.
Sure.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair and honorable members of the Alaska State Legislature and the House Resource Committee, for the record, I am Rosita Kahani-Wurl, and I am a member of the AFN Subsistence Committee. And for the record, I am an anthropologist. I've conducted research on subsistence for about more than 40 years throughout the circumpolar Arctic and in Alaska. And I've probably served on the Subsistence Committee for about as long as that. And so I know what happened in 1990. I was here on the floor in the hallway as a young lady trying to urge our legislators to adopt that resolution to allow the citizens to vote on an action that I knew that the citizens of Alaska supported at that point in time. Thank you for allowing me to comment on HJR 22, which embodies an issue of great significance for Alaskans and notably for Alaska Native community. Thank you also for bringing this issue, which has divided the state for decades, to an open forum. Hopefully, through rational, honest, and sincere dialogue with all stakeholders at the table, we may be able to formulate a unified position. If I may, I would like to introduce myself in accordance with our cultural protocols. My introduction will also reveal the spiritual interrelationships that we maintain with our animals, birds, and fish. It will also demonstrate the cultural dimensions of subsistence that are rarely known or understood outside of the subsistence community. My Tlingit names are Yedetlitzak. It's an ancient name. The meaning has been lost in time. My ceremonial name is Kahani, which refers to the stature or status of an individual. In the ceremony in which I received this name, our clan leader said that my stature was woman who stands in the place of a man. I am an eagle of the Thunderbird clan and the house lord from the sun from Klokwan in the Chilkat region. I am also a child of the Sockeye clan. My identity is intertwined with our clan crests, the eagle, Thunderbird, and sun. We of our clan are spiritually strengthened by the eagle, Thunderbird, sun, and Sockeye. But our clan also has spiritual relationships with the white bear, the shark, and the killer whale. In attempting to address and resolve the subsistence issue, or more specifically, the dual management regime between the federal and state governments, and in proposing and developing solutions, including a constitutional amendment that provides for the protection of subsistence, it will be necessary to have an understanding of the multiple elements affecting subsistence. Many changes have occurred in the 34 years since the federal government took over subsistence management authority on federal lands. We natives, for one, gave up trying to amend the state constitution after spending nearly $20 million in attempting to seek this constitutional amendment. We have citizens who grew up living with dual management and have grown accustomed to this systems. We have tribal members who now favor working through the federal subsistence boards. We also have a growing subsistence insistence that indigenous knowledge, science, and language be incorporated into resource management regimes and decisions. These changes will have to be considered as we assess proposed constitutional amendments and a possible unified management regime. It will also be necessary to understand the legal and political history that gave rise to the situation in which we find ourselves today. This context is complex and subject to differing interpretations and orientations, making our task more difficult. Native people both revere and utilize the land and its resources. Thus, it will be imperative to have a clear understanding of the cultural significance of subsistence. This dimension has given Native people the stamina to fight for our basic cultural survival and our identity and subsistence rights, which are all intertwined with our physical and spiritual relationship to the land, resources, and subsistence. Native people will insist that these cultural values and practices are considered and integrated into subsistence management regimes. Knowledge about the dual economies that characterize communities, integrating both subsistence and cash economy, is also another important consideration. Native people must be engaged in discussions and have a place at the table in addressing a unified management regime. Thank you for this opportunity to present our preliminary assessment of the elements that we believe are necessary to consider in developing a constitutional amendment that can bring a state-level unified management regime that includes subsistence protections. Winnetish. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosita, for those comments. It's very informative. Okay, so next we have Gayla Hoseth. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Gayla Hoseth. Can you hear me?
It was close. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, okay. Good afternoon. It's Gayla Hossett. And afternoon, Mr. Chairman. That's okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gayla Hossett, as I stated earlier, and I'm currently the AFN Subsistence Chair. I'm also the first chief of my tribe in Chugan Tribal Council located in Dillingham, Alaska, and also the Director of Natural Resources for Bristol Bay Native Association. Thank you for letting me speak today, and thank you for letting President AFN Julie Kitka speak as well as Dr. Rosita Rural, a member of the AFN Subsistence Committee. You know, this is a really important topic that we're talking about today, and I just wanted to emphasize that during the 2023 AFN convention, our theme that we had was our ways of life. We had hours of testimony from people all over Alaska expressing how important subsistence is to maintain our traditional way of life. We had to come up with a plan because so many people wanted to speak that we had to have a plan to make sure that every region was heard on this issue. If we could have had a two-week-long session where people would be able to come and testify as how much subsistence way of life means to them. Living off the land has sustained our people for thousands of years, and that has been stated before. It's important for the state to understand our subsistence way of life, and I've attended many Board of Fish and many Board of Game meetings, and during those transcripts and during testimony, there's a wealth of knowledge and testimony that advocates how important subsistence is. And I just want to let everybody know, as you may know and you may not know, that at the recent Upper Cook Inlet March 5th Board of Fisheries meeting, the board adopted the Alaska Board of Fisheries policy on traditional knowledge. That goes to show that we have knowledge in what we have on as we are the stewards of our land with the resources that that have sustained our people. I would like to offer and to reiterate what Ms. Kitka stated about a lunch and learn. I think that would be really important that we do that on HJR 2022. And we also offer the assistance in helping coordinate the fact-finding that she stated. Something that might be a good consideration for members of the committee and also decision makers to do this summer and throughout the fall is as travel out to the villages, travel out to the communities, and see what subsistence means to the people across Alaska. You know, every community and every village has its own culture, and that is really important. I've traveled to many villages, and just to see that across the state, we have so many common things, but each place has its own culture, and that has so much meaning for all of our people. We also would like to have a workshop at the 2024 annual convention. That would be a great place and time as everybody from across Alaska is gathering for our annual convention, and that we can have a focus on that so that people can understand the impacts of this bill of how it would be across the state of Alaska. It's also important for Alaskans to learn, understand, and be able to be involved in this process. Most importantly, people's voices must be heard on this important subject that impacts our traditional way of life. This is a big topic, and it requires a big conversation across the state. I would be happy to help in any way that I can as AFN Subsistence Chair moving forward and help getting outreach and how we can work within AFN and across the state of Alaska. And for this, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time and members of the committee. And I look forward to meeting you in person. I'm sorry I'm not able to be there today. I know some of you and some of you I don't. So thank you for the time today.
You're very welcome. Gayla, could you give me the dates of your annual convention so we could
Third week in October, the Thursday, Friday.
I'm sorry?
Third
week in October. Okay.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And just to tell you how when we said Representative Baker's bill came out of the blue, last year at our convention when we spent hours on this, there wasn't any consideration of a constitutional amendment because we had no indication at all that the state or legislature, anybody was interested in doing it. So our focus in the whole discussions there was improving the federal process and the federal statutes and making sure that our protections were solid. So just that's when I say it came out of the blue. Even last year at the convention, I doubt if there was one person that mentioned a constitutional amendment. They didn't.
Okay. Well, Representative Baker.
Thank you through the chair. And I would like to say to that, I appreciate that clarification. And I would just like to clarify, Madam President, I was fortunate enough to be an invited person to speak at the convention during one of the opportunities for folks from the different regions of the state to speak. It was prior to my being appointed to the legislature. And so what I was really hoping to do with this piece of legislation is understanding it's late in the game. We're nearing the end of the second year of this session. It's not likely that this will pass and that people will have the time to do all of the ground and footwork to research and come up with a position on it. So I really, really appreciate you and the folks from AFN being available to help start the conversation and give us AFN's perspective so that we can move forward having an actual in-depth conversation, have the research done. And I'd really like to thank the chair for allowing this invited testimony today, as I feel it brings a lot of depth to the conversation that it really needs.
You're very welcome. And we do have one more testifier. Commissioner Vincent Lang, would you like to put yourself on the record and begin your testimony on this subject?
Sure. My name for the record is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Again, I said it earlier when I was testifying regarding the last bill. Sorry, I can't be there. I'm up in Fairbanks right now attending the Board of Game meeting, and we're also talking about how we're going to rebuild stocks of fish that are important to subsistence users in the Yukon River. So I've been meeting with the TCC Town Chiefs Conference as well as holding some joint AC meetings to try to hammer out agreement on how to better manage Yukon salmon so that we're meeting subsistence needs and rebuilding those stocks from both the Canadian and U.S. side of the border. The resolution sponsor asked me to be here today to provide some additional examples of how dual management is not working and is complicating resource management. Before I want to begin, I want to reemphasize to the committee that subsistence is the priority under state statute. Let's first look at Southeast Alaska. The Federal Subsistence Board is considering closing federal lands to deer hunting to non-federally qualified users. There is absolutely no data to support the closure of federal lands in Southeast Alaska to non-federally qualified users. There is no evidence that reasonable opportunity for subsistence users is not being provided for. And there's no evidence of conservation concerns. In fact, this area has one of the most robust deer populations in the state, with the highest success rates for deer hunters in the state of Alaska. If adopted, this will unnecessarily restrict non-federally qualified users from hunting on federal lands. For example, people living in Juneau would no longer be eligible to hunt on federal lands in Southeast Alaska, when in fact they've done that for decades and eons over time. Next, let's look at the Mulchatna caribou herd. The Mulchatna caribou herd is no longer providing for subsistence needs. While reasons for the declines are complex, predation is a significant factor impacting herd recovery. Local villages and the Alaska Federation of Natives asked the state to design and conduct predator management on this herd. Based on this, the Board of Game Action, the state implemented a predator control effort to rebuild this herd. Our success, however, is impacted by the prohibition of predation control on federal lands. This prohibition is impacting the recovery of this herd. But what is most frustrating is that if the state program is successful, we have been told that the federal government will allocate the entire harvestable surplus to federally qualified users. This will force the state to close or restrict hunting on state lands, despite the fact that we rebuilt the herd. State subsistence hunters will be unfairly impacted. This is nothing new. The federal government has a history of taking from the efforts of others. You just have to look at the Berners Bay moose in Southeast Alaska and all the work locals did to introduce moose to that location. I want to emphasize the words introduce moose. The state did this introduction, not the federal government. Once the herd grew to provide a harvestable surplus, the federal government decided the majority of that surplus was theirs to take. They are now looking to take a portion of the harvestable surplus of wood bison, another species that was introduced by the state in order to provide food security. Let's now look at the Yukon River. There is a proposal to the Federal Subsistence Board to close areas within the Yukon River to non-federally qualified users and to delegate to their in-season manager the ability to manage the fishery in areas under federal jurisdiction, including opening and closures. This will significantly impact the state's ability to meet international treaty obligations and to assure that residents living further from the mouth of the river will have access to fish for subsistence resources. This is akin to what I described in the Kuskokwim, where downriver users get more opportunities at the expense of upriver users. Finally, it will unnecessarily impact the ability of people who have cultural ties to that resource that are now displaced into urban areas for health, education, or employment reasons to practice their culture and traditions. Finally, let's look at the Nelchina caribou hunt. Federal agencies are extremely hesitant to take any action to restrict or close hunting opportunities to federally qualified users, even when there are demonstrated conservation concerns. In 2022, after the state analyzed the spring and summer surveys, we decided it was necessary to restrict, for conservation reasons, the state hunts for Nelchina caribou to bulls only. We immediately contacted the Bureau of Land Management Field Office in Glen Allen, as they hold a delegation of authority from the Federal Subsistence Board to make in-season management decisions. After a number of discussions, they told us that, despite conservation concerns, it was too late for them to do anything, as they had already sent out permits for distribution with the pre-existing hunt stipulations on them. But they would stress that federally qualified users did not harvest cow caribou if at all possible. We now know this did not work, as there was no reduction in cow harvest in those federal hunts. This impacted the herd. In 2003, based on new data that reinforced our conservation concerns regarding the Nelchina herd, my staff made a concerted effort to communicate with the BLM field office the need to close federal hunts on Nelchina caribou. This proved extremely difficult as there was no singular point of contact for us, and they kept having us discuss the issue with someone different. Eventually, they brought in a biologist who wasn't even in Alaska for us to talk to. No one seemed to be able to make the call. So after weeks of trying, we decided to submit a special action to the Federal Subsistence Board to take action to conserve Nelchina caribou. As many of you know, the Alcina hunt is now closed for conservation reasons, likely for years. Again, bottom line, dual management is impacting subsistence and in some cases conservation. I also want to remind the committee that the passage of this resolution is one of several steps that would be needed to be taken to address the issue moving forward. And with that, I'm open to any questions you may have. And I'll just also close by saying, you know, the state is really, we tried to work under dual management for years, and we've been trying to ensure for not only conservation, but wise use management. We're also reaching out across the table to try to figure out how we can bring additional voices into the management program that we currently have in place. But, you know, as you dual management with different goals and outcomes is complicating how we can provide for conservation and subsistence needs across the state. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, you're welcome, Commissioner Vincent Lang. Thank you very much. I'm going to go off script, which sometimes my staff gets really upset if I do this, but I think it's important since we have a little extra time. I'd like to ask one of our most experienced legislators, Representative Edgman, would you like to come up and give us some advice on this topic? Not to put you on the spot, but I guess I did anyway. And please put your name on the record, obviously, Representative, and give us a few minutes of your wisdom, because this is a really big one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and member of the committee. And Ms. Kitka, it's really great to see you in Juneau, and I really appreciate your informed testimony on a subject that I was just in the back sitting there thinking, you know, we're in the midst of educational reform, or we're in the midst of trying to put a fiscal plan together, and these very sort of, you know, larger than life issues that are before us here in the legislature, and really before all of Alaska. But subsistence, you could, you know, apply an exponential factor to that. It's that huge. It's that complicated. And, you know, there's no better place to start than really, as Ms. Kitka was talking about, starting from an educational standpoint, getting legislators, you know, and other stakeholders, of course, to understand the fundamentals and to go back into time. And I remember I was down here in 1990 when that constitutional amendment failed in the House by one vote. Very dramatic. And I think it was in the summertime. I was in a special session. I was back in Bristol Bay in a fishing boat when it actually occurred, I think. But I've been here through a number of subsistence battles back in the Hickle days, back later on in the 90s during the Knowles era and so forth. And it's been a topic that as Ms. Kitka and Ms. Dr. Worrell described you, is in its immensity something that's going to take weeks and months and perhaps even longer than that to really bring not just the policy components together, but also the sort of the political, the stakeholders component in place. And I would close by saying that I'm Alaska Native, and this topic is near and dear to me. Yep. And I just want to, again, go on support for what AFN has put forward. And really, Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for, you know, the impromptu comments, and really appreciate the fact that you're taking a look at this issue right now.
Thank you, Representative Edgman, very much. Sorry for the put you on the spot, but I knew you'd have something very wise to say to us on that topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for any of our testifiers? Representative Mears.
Thank you. Again, a comment through the chair. I deeply appreciate your being here. I deeply appreciate everyone's engagement and dedication to a thorough process for looking at this. You're absolutely correct that this is an issue that needs to be discussed and decided in more than the walls in this room. And I appreciate your coming here and our future work together as we work through this.
Okay, Representative Dybert.
I thank you to the chair. And just a comment, I'll start with comment, then I have a question, clarifying question. Just like what Representative Muir said, thank you so much for coming here and testifying for our people. I'm Koi Kanath Baskin, so I really appreciate the words. My family has hunted and fished on our lands for hundreds and hundreds of years, so your comments mean a lot to me. So I just wanted, I don't know who could answer this, but to clarify,
We'll find somebody.
Do you feel the federal protections of subsistence as defined in ANILCA and the U.S. Constitution and Statehood Compact are more rigorous than they would be if this HDR 22 is adopted as written? Thank you.
You're welcome. Ms. Kitka, would you like to answer that? Or sure. Try to answer it?
I'll try to answer that.
Okay. Please put your name on the record.
First of all, we have inherent rights to our existence and to our culture and our language and our ways of life and our rights. And we have a political relationship with the United States government that derives from the U.S. Constitution. And those are very precious to us, and they develop, and there's hundreds of pieces of federal legislation that codify different aspects of that. And that is a living process that's going on. Since the last time we dealt with this, like 25 years ago or whatever on that, there's been a lot of changes that have occurred. There's a greater capacity within the Native community to take on more of these things ourselves, and people are seeking to have that delegated authority, whether or not it's from the state or the federal government. They want to run more of their lives themselves. And we have a diversity within our Native community. Not everybody agrees with everything on that. And so people come up with other solutions that they would work with their areas on that. And we want you to open up a process that recognizes that diversity, listens to people, but also sees the changes that have occurred in the last 25 years and trust that the capability of the Native community can rise to have a greater role in the system and process than it was 25 years ago. You look at the constitutional amendments that were introduced then, you didn't have a lot of co-management going on and delegated authority from the federal government. Now you have a lot of interest on the federal side in co-management, developing and having Native fish and game officers and scientists and a greater wanting to build the capabilities and opportunities for our people on that. So as you take a look at that, take a look at the evolution that has occurred. Don't think of it as at one point in time, this is what people wanted and why don't they want it now? Because times change. The circumstances are not the same as they were 25 years ago. That answer your question?
Follow up? Yeah,
follow up
sure.
To the chair.
Yes.
Completely agree. Our, you know, on the Yukon River, we haven't had fish in 5 or 6 or 7 years now. And just, you know, my mom the other day said, you know, at least we have the memory of the taste of it, which is really sad. So so things have changed and it needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Dibert? I want to make sure you get a complete opportunity here to ask anything you'd like.
I'm good.
Okay. Anyone else? Doctor.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may also try to answer that question. I think there's been, you know, I talked about changes that have gone on, and there have been good changes within the state. I mean, the state recognition of tribes, I think that is, you know, some great progress that I think will help us in our discussions about unified management. The state tribal compacting in education, I think that's another step. It shows that the state is willing to recognize, you know, that Alaska Natives do, in fact, have a special status. You know, when I was in a governor's office serving as special staff assistant, I did a study. And at that point in time, I showed that what I was able to identify was that Alaska Native, because of their special political status, brought in hundreds of millions of dollars into the state. And we know that number, you know, has quadrupled since I did that study. But so, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note, you know, that I see that there's been progress within the state that I think is going to help us in this discussion as we move forward.
Good. Thank you for those comments. Okay. Are there any other questions, comments? All right. Seeing none, I'd like to thank our testifiers today. This is very interesting and brings back a lot of memories.
It brought memories to us,
yeah,
too.
Oh, boy. No crying. No crying.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the courtesy of having us You're very welcome. And thank you, Representative Baker, for starting the conversation on that.
So, okay. So with that, we'll conclude that topic. And our next meeting of the Resources Committee will be Friday at 1 o'clock. And seeing no other business before us, I will adjourn us at 2:26 p.m. And thank you, everyone.